When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to five pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome back to another episode of the Friends from Work Plus Mary Marvel Watching Society walkthrough of X-Men. And I mean, if you didn't already know what you were getting into based on that intro music, then I don't really know what we can do here. But I feel about as hyped as one can feel to discuss X3. The Last Stand, or X-Men The Last Stand, X3 X-Men The Last Stand. I don't know. I feel like I see this movie referred to a lot of different ways. But hey, welcome. We made it.
You know what's too bad? The X-Men universe has multiple options for incredibly recognizable Avengers-style themes. And yet, how did they never continue certain themes on? Like, when you made the live-action stuff, why not use the like, why not keep that going? Or why not do the X-Men 97 theme?
Yeah.
Like, that's what the Avengers would have done, even if it was slightly different. You had such a golden opportunity.
Yeah, it is. It's
so representative of so much of the X-Men universe. Like,
yeah.
You had it there. You had a great idea. You didn't know how to follow up on it. And there's just absolutely no continuity between the three of them.
I know. It's like, I think in some ways it makes sense that they would want to break. Like, I get breaking with the 90s, and I want to talk about that some at the end of the episode. But yeah, I've always found this scene to be pretty memorable. And I think what's just weird about where it goes after the original trilogy is, like, you never really have another recognizable theme. Like, we talked about how the First Class theme by Henry Jackman was fine, but not really something that, like, sticks in your mind. And I think when they come back to the original, I think the X2 composer, when Bryan Singer brings him back for Days of Future Past, like, I know that that's the theme that they pulled from in the Marvel's post-credit scene. But honestly, like, I cannot right here talking to you even hum that theme. Not because it's bad, but just because, like, I had so much time with this original one and it's so baked in that it's like, yeah, if they, like, now made a new Avengers movie and just did an entirely different theme first and then maybe, like, another weird, like, amalgamation of that and the original, I just think at that point you've kind of lost the opportunity and it starts getting watered down.
It's just, again, why we're so lucky that we had Alan Silvestri nail the original melody the first time.
Yeah.
And so then you could be like, we're using this every time for the next 15 years, maybe 30 years.
Well, and even like the way that other composers have been able to play with that in movies that either feature the Avengers. And, like, I think we brought this up when we were first doing our Homecoming episode and it felt like such a reach. But when you were here the other day, I was showing you that I recently got this, I got the Homecoming score on vinyl and have been listening to it a lot more because of that. And I am like more and more convinced that there is some level, we've talked about this too. There are Reddit threads on it, which doesn't mean anything, but I'm at least not the only one that hears in Giacchino's Vulture theme. He's kind of doing like a reverse Avengers theme. And it even, because it's like that opening scene that starts with him in the wreckage. And so they play the Avengers theme. And then that slowly transitions to the Vulture, which is like not, it's like such a subtle thing, but it has the same like rhythm. And it's just, yeah. So it's kind of like, it is sort of playing on like, this is the dark impact of what the Avengers have been, or this is like the kind of like anti-Tony Stark.
So every time we finish a film, Pete, our manager, asks for a one-word review. What is your one-word review of X3? The Last Stand.
Oh, man.
One word. Anticlimactic is my word while you're thinking. And my wife and I watched this together. I was surprised at how much I actually remembered of this film. I thought I had never seen it. I think I've seen it one time, and certain scenes came back to me as we approached them. My wife had never seen any of it. And it's supposed to be this epic finale, epic conclusion. Think Return of the King. Think, you know, Avengers Infinity War slash Endgame. And it just doesn't feel right. Something doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel grand enough in scale. I don't understand why Magneto doesn't feel right. He should be madder about Charles's death.
Yeah.
And then he's not. And then somehow in this crazy epic thing, they find a way to make it feel really small on Alcatraz.
Right.
Like isolated from the rest of the world.
Right.
Even though it's a world issue, like I never feel like the world is actually threatened at that time.
Yeah.
Like worst case scenario, they're just going to get the cure, which doesn't affect humanity.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just feels anticlimactic.
So I think my one word review would be, disappointing.
Okay.
But wow. But on like a lot of levels, like not just like, I think one thing that I took away from this movie this time around, having watched the originals and then having watched it how we did, which I want to get into in a second as well, some of the premises here, like if you were to sketch out this plot in very broad strokes, I actually think a lot of it is solid as a conclusion to the series. Like I think the cure.
So there's a mutant whose power is to cure mutant powers, or like get rid of your mutant powers. So humans build a cure out of that.
Which is,
and they,
did you catch that's Leech, the same character that we saw with Magneto and Remember It?
Oh, I did not. Okay, cool. So then humans are giving mutants an option to get out of their mutant powers, but Magneto thinks that eventually that'll be turned against them, like a la weapons.
Right.
Which it kind of is. And so he's going to kill that child so they don't have that option anymore. Although they've already made the cure, Magneto. But yes.
Yeah, and they have like
broad strokes, and Jean's alive and is a bipolar crazy phoenix.
Which, so
like multiple personalities.
Yeah, like I think that like the cure as a way for talking about like the identity piece of being a mutant, like this, like the way that Storm is debating, which is kind of interesting having just seen the last few episodes of 97, that she's on the side of like, I can't imagine anybody ever wanting to take this, which is also like, I don't want to get too far into execution, but just cracks me up. She's like looking Beast dead in the eyes. And she's like, what coward would take this just to blend in? And I'm like, man, read the room, Storm. But
Beast is like, I might. Maybe,
I mean, honestly, but I like,
it's like Kevin from The Office. Someone has it.
Yeah,
but no one here has it.
I even think like the Phoenix as an eventual outgrowth of Jean's own suppressed subconscious instead of a cosmic entity works in the context of the series. Like, I do think for you to suddenly, like, they have to try to do the Dark Phoenix thing, because that is like arguably the most famous X-Men story. And they had set that up pretty well in X2 with like that early conversation with her and Scott, where he's like, before Liberty Island, you had trouble like moving a book across the room. And now it's like when you have a nightmare, the whole bedroom shakes. Like I that's where I look back and I'm like, okay, like the groundwork was laid where these ideas could have been really interesting, even combined, because like, I think that the fact that it all culminates in this final battle over the cure, and it's really like this distillation of the Charles approach and the Eric approach that we've kind of looked at through all of these movies, and that it's coming down to like, okay, well, here's kind of where like the rubber meets the road. Like, now they have a cure. Now they can eradicate us. What are they going to do? And what do we do in response? And then to put like a mutant right at the center of that, that is the most powerful one that has kind of been raised up by Charles, but kind of at her base subconscious level thinks more like Eric. Like, that's a really interesting situation as like a way of resolving all of these threads, to where it's like, I can imagine a studio looking at that script, or not the script necessarily, but looking at like the outline and saying like, yeah, that makes sense. This could be really cool. And I feel like that is where I would give Zach Penn credit here. You'll remember when we were talking about X2.
Good work, Zach.
Zach was he had like a story credit on that. And then, you know, we talk about him obviously coming back for the Incredible Hulk and Avengers, and how like, I think the Avengers is a really great example of Zach Penn being someone that I think has pretty good story sensibilities, but needs somebody else that can script well. And Joss Whedon provided that in that movie. Obviously, Joss Whedon was not here in this movie. He almost was, which I'll get to later. But I do think like that, I saw the Zach Penn name and I was like, yeah, I think that about fits with where I've seen his name pop up. Like, I think he has good instincts, but I don't think he has the ability to always execute those, especially when you're paired with what I think here was just a disaster of a director. Because I think a lot of what you were just getting at with like the scope of just how everything feels, I felt that too. And it's like everything that we talked about in the first two installments that Singer directed, where it's like, man, he just knows how to do this well. Like, there's a finesse to it. Like, I'm thinking of like that, the Nightcrawler opening shot in X2, Wolverine jumping off the balcony, like just some cool, like, this is X-Men moments. And I feel like none of that is here.
Nope. I mean, how do you want me to do this? Can I lay out some of the things I don't like, some misses?
Maybe
I got so much here.
Specifically in the directing side. Like, I don't want to get too much more into the story yet, because I want to go back through a few things. But like, did you notice kind of where like things just feel lifeless and kind of like oddly, it's like everything's kind of awkward?
Yeah. I know. That's what I started the whole episode with. something feels off.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is necessarily. I'm not going to go through each individual element, but yeah, the whole thing feels anticlimactic because the scope isn't there. I don't know if it's like the framing of certain shots. Again, I can't analyze it, but something feels off a lot of the movie.
I wrote down the same note. I'm like, is it like a camera work thing? Because there are parts of it that are that, I think, like where certain things just don't look as like, I don't know. It's weird. It's like the opposite of like a Winter Soldier style. You know, where it's like everything is so kind of up close and the shaky cam and whatever that like you feel really in it all the time. Like this is the polar opposite of that, where it's like everything feels like you're watching it from like 20 feet away and none of it's very interesting.
So one other note on the watch order thing. I am very undecided on this. It's not that I don't appreciate your work, Rob. Obviously, I appreciate the time and effort you put into it. But I think I'm a weird poster child for maybe I should have just watched release order because I have such faint memories of these films that are influencing like different thoughts and ideas, but they're not grounded. And I don't know the order these are in. And so I'm already struggling with some of the continuity here. And then... Right. Going back kind of messes with that. But then I guess at the same time, there are certain things that are just messy regardless. Like there are certain calls that I can't understand. So in this movie, for example, Trask is a large African-American man, right?
Right.
But they know Days of Future Past, like when they cast that, why did they cast a little person, white person?
Yeah.
Like why not... If you're going to make Days of Future Past, then at least cast some younger African-American dude who's like in the military and looks like it could fit. Like that's confusing to me because I have this like picture of Trask and Trask to me is Peter Dinklage. Like, that's what I know. So I'm like, wait, that's Trask? There's just all kinds of stuff too where I'm like the Charles walking versus not walking thing.
Right.
So at the beginning of this movie, they de-age him and then he's walking. That doesn't make sense after First Class.
Right. Which we talked about in Origins too.
It doesn't make sense there either.
So,
and then like I had to write down one of my first notes was we haven't seen an adult Beast yet. Correct.
Right.
That was confusing to me because I remember Kelsey Grammer's Beast like this, like foggy memories of it. But then I was not well versed in the release order. So I'm like, have we seen him yet? Is this the first introduction? And I was surprised. Oh, well, to no, see I mean,
we
in
did
movie.
In First Class. I just didn't know what you meant by adult,
as young.
I guess. Yeah.
Well, not Kelsey Grammer though.
Right, right. Yeah. No, not Kelsey Grammer. Yeah. Just the.
So I guess my question then is if Hank McCoy is in First Class, what did he do during X1 and 2? Why was there no checkup on an adult Hank?
Well, I think that we get the little aside where he's like, you know, you're a part of this place. So I think like it's just supposed to be that he was part of like the initial class of X-Men, but then has.
But don't you think that's strange? That then, like, he's risen to one of the highest levels of power in the government, and we didn't hear about it in the first two films.
Right. I mean, no, for sure. But I think
anyways, my point is, that's maybe not a watchword thing. My point is, it's just generally confusing on a lot of details.
That is where I wanted to start, actually. So that's kind of perfect. Like, I'd love to use the very poorly de-aged opening, which like really upset Candace to look at.
It's not good here.
In fairness, as she said, you know, it's 2006. You just can't really do it. So just don't. Just, if anything, you know, be aggressive with the makeup, do what you can. But like, I don't think anyone's, because also like Xavier and Magneto don't really look old in this movie. Like you don't really, they don't start to look like they're really, really aging until you get closer to Days of Future Past territory. So I'm like, I don't think you had to go that hard, but
Right.
Anyway, I did want to talk timeline a bit because first off, I would say I think that this Watch Order does work a lot better without Origins, which is how I originally conceived it. And I should stress, we only watched Origins for purposes of this particular rewatch because we're culminating with the Deadpool Wolverine movie. I think if I were to tell somebody to just watch the X-Men saga, I would not include that. I would probably, if I were going to say that, honestly, just go from like basically watch the order that we've watched it in, pull Origins out, and then end with like Logan, and then kind of treat Deadpool as a different thing. I think trying to make it all combine is obviously a mess. That said, I do think I stand by it because as confusing as it is here, I think that the release order is confusing in its own ways. Where,
yeah, like, that's what I was kind of getting at.
Well, and, like, I think at least here it's like from here on out, like we've done our backtracking, right? Like we got to the end of X2 and then we kind of go back in and get more context from Charles and Eric. And then, especially if you don't do the Origins thing, kind of meet back up with the end of their journey together. And I think that that then makes it all feel like, okay, this is all one story, even though like this one film was a flashback. I think the release order, if you're trying to make it one story, gets kind of confusing because you watch The Last Stand and then the next movie release-wise was Origins, which was actually being filmed, I think, at the same time as Last Stand, or was like at least in development at the same time. And those clearly operate within the same time frame or timeline because you have the same issues with Professor X. He looks the same when he's de-aged. The like, it all kind of adds up. Like if he's going around getting mutants in the way he is in Origins, it would make sense that he's doing that at the start of The Last Stand. But then the next movie after that in release order is First Class, which was kind of sort of a reboot like we talked about, but then wasn't. And then the next movie after that is The Wolverine, which follows up directly on the events of this film. So I feel like if you do it that way, it's kind of like, wait, what versions of these characters are they? And also like, what's the significance of this now? Because we've already kind of seen this relationship resolve to some degree in The Last Stand. So it sort of feels pointless to watch it after the fact. And then also like now we're coming back and picking up right after The Last Stand, tracing Logan's next steps, not right after like years wise, but like the next thing sequentially. And I think just having the First Class thing hanging there, it doesn't really make any sense. So I think that's why like I would, from now on, at least, we can kind of follow the journey chronologically and follow each group and know what's going on. I think that it's just like there's probably no great way to watch these because of the lack of care for continuity. But I do think that I'm happy with this being the end of that initial story and kind of letting First Class speak to that in some degree and hopefully kind of enhance elements of this movie that don't work by like adding a bit more emotional heft to like the loss of Charles than the movie actually gives you, because you know what he and Eric have been through, even if it doesn't show up there. And I think like ending it here where it's like, this is in fact like the last entry in that chapter, and then kind of seeing where it goes. I don't know. I can see an argument for both. If we take the origins out of it, especially, I do think that it makes for a better Charles Eric saga. But I know we've gotten some messages from people kind of going back and forth on what they think the right order is. And I think that release order is the obvious way. And maybe it's like, since there's no really great way to do it, you just go about it there. I have this like mental illness where I have to try to make everything make as much sense as it can.
Which is why I'm just letting you go. I'm letting you go right now. Just
that's why we're here.
Dog off the leash. Here we go. All right, here we go.
It's my turn to crush.
I'm about to crush this movie. There's a couple things that really bother me, okay? Magneto as a character, this is by far his worst entry. Uh-huh. And it plot-wise, it doesn't make sense. Like, a lot of stuff that they're having Magneto do doesn't make sense. Or he just sucks at it all of a sudden. And it kind of takes some of the aura and shine away from him. Like, for example, I think it's, you already touched on this. I felt like when Charles died, I actually was moved by Storm and Wolverine's reaction, but it's totally inappropriate. Like, Eric would have been way more bummed about it. Think about the Eric in First Class.
Right.
Like, he kind of just goes, oh, Charles, no. Oh, okay, time to move on. Jean, you're coming with us.
Right.
And like, when Mystique gets turned into a human, are you kidding me that Magneto bails on her that fast? Like, even a smart Magneto would know.
Yeah.
Like, she may still be helpful to the cause as a human. But to literally leave her lying there naked and just go, oh, screw you.
I thought that was
And
such,
she took the bullet for him.
Yeah. Oh, man. It was such a terrible scene in so many ways and such a disgrace to the Magneto character. Like,
well, because it's bad writing. Because like he wouldn't do that. Like that's not realistic to the Magneto we've seen thus far.
Yeah.
Also, like, he sucks as a general. Like, his entire actual strategy blows. So first of all, he's gonna take the Golden Gate Bridge, which is a massive move, rip it into shreds, and bring it over to Alcatraz, which, by the way, isn't factual. The Golden Gate Bridge could not reach Alcatraz. It's not that close to the shore. It's in the middle of the lake. So that's not true. In San Francisco people, Joanna, Lance, you can check me on that, right? That's not correct. but his plan is to bring it over. Why? Like, they don't need to be escorted. Like, it's not like they're bringing people from the mainland to Alcatraz. Why even connect it between the two? Then the whole let's let the pawns go first thing is such horrible. Like, Magneto, you could save all of their lives by just starting by throwing metal things at these people or tying all the bad guys up. Like, you don't need all these people to get turned into humans. It's terrible military generalness. Then him like making everybody wait and the whole thing to really just kind of stand there the whole time and then ultimately get defeated pretty easily.
Right.
Like, his entire strategy doesn't make sense either.
Especially because he has Jean there. Like, what's the point of any of that?
Right. So not only does it feel small scale, he's off as a character.
Yeah.
It's not charming anymore. He's not making sense. He's kind of making dumb moves.
Yeah.
Like, stupid, illogical mistakes.
And
like, the Golden Gate Bridge things feels like they were literally just trying to say, let's make this super epic. He's going to carry the Golden Gate Bridge. But then no one actually said, but why? Like, why does he need the bridge?
Right.
Per se. You know what I mean? Like, what about the bridge?
Yeah. Well, and I also noticed, like, at the very end of that scene, like, the place where he and Jean have been standing, where, like, all of the kind of final showdown stuff goes, that, like, I think that's just, like, right in front of where all those cars are lined up, like, at the end of the bridge, which also feels so, like that feels small scale. Like, it, when it's, at least when it's zoomed up, like when it's on Jean and Wolverine, they're kind of making it feel epic. Like, you're on some kind of battlefield, but then like you zoom out and it's like, yeah, like they're basically in like the parking lot of this facility.
The other character that unfortunately feels off and is his worst entry thus far is Logan.
Yeah.
I felt like this is, I mean, maybe by far the worst Logan we've ever had. And Hugh Jackman seems a little bit to be walking through it.
Yeah.
Not only do his lines not make as much sense, why is he all of a sudden such a jerk? why is Logan out of nowhere now? Like, if this was the vibe they wanted to go for, for all the films, I would get it. But especially after Origins Wolverine and stuff, where like he kind of gets softened and we've seen some character development there. And Logan, like in the first X-Men, is he's the one that doesn't want to be involved, whatever. But by X2, he is the one that's kind of leading the charge and Logan's on board.
Right.
And then here we just get the like sarcastic, like, I don't care about any of this, Logan, the whole time.
Right.
And I don't really get that either.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't feel his performance of murdering Jean either. Like, I don't know. Logan and Magneto, two of the drivers of the series, are two of the lesser characters in this movie to me.
Yeah, it's, no, I think that that's right. Like, I thought the same thing in some ways, like, because that was one thing we talked about in Origins, that like at least Hugh Jackman showed up, you know, like it's such a bad movie, but he is generally trying to make the most of each scene. And that's, again, though, that's where I'm going to go back to Brett Ratner here as just like,
agreed,
the direction is so rough.
It's like he jumped in this late in the game and had read some comics and was like, you know what? Logan's supposed to be a little more disgruntled and kind of gruff. So let's go with that without taking into consideration what he had already been doing.
Yeah.
Basically.
Which, and that is the thing with the series, right? Like I think that the MCU...
Not taking into any consideration what's been happening already, basically, the whole thing.
Yeah, it's like the MCU, I always...
Which way are you going? Just stick with it once you choose it.
Or at least, like, make it make sense, you know? Like, if you want to, like there are examples of something like, you know, like, you look at the Thor franchise and the step that's taken between Dark World and Ragnarok. Like, those movies could not be more different tonally. The character is like so much funnier and like there's all this additional commentary but at least we like start off with Thor in more or less the last place we left him. And then kind of by the end of that movie, we understand how he's transitioning into Taika's version of Thor. This series just has no interest. Like it's as if a director like Taika were to come in and say like, okay, I think these movies could be way more fun. I want this element. I want this element.
Yes.
But then doing it in a way that like they never even watched the first two movies.
Thor is such a perfect example. We talk about it all the time on the main feed. All the time. You could literally track his entire progression on a piece of paper. Like I could tell you right now, you know, it's like the king needs to be humbled, gets humbled, you know, finds Earth. It's a whole new world, starting to question things from his parents, then lead us into Ragnarok. And that's what's happening in Ultron. Like, oh, now he's starting to question certain things. And then he loses in Infinity War and Brett loses everything and has to bounce back from that. And now we're overcompensating. Like it all makes so much sense where each step took us, right? Like that's why you and I were fans of Endgame with him.
Right.
Because it was the next logical step. Yeah, you're so right. This is like the polar opposite. Like Magneto leaving Mystique because now she's human doesn't make any sense with the character.
No.
We've never seen that. We've never seen that be the next step.
Especially like there are
especially
little...
Not in that way, especially.
Right.
Like maybe like a conversation later of like, you know what? I just don't think this, you can help us a whole lot anymore. It's no offense.
Yeah.
But it's just like, to like leave her in such a humiliating way, literally lying naked on the ground and say like, well, you're dead to us. Only to have her then obviously be pissed about it.
Yeah. I mean, the whole it's thing like, takes like.
So that's the other thing. He also just sucks at his job right now because like there's no consideration of this could backfire, I guess.
Yeah,
like she knows stuff, dude.
Yeah, and it's just so like we've talked about this in the context of X-Men 97. Like the interesting thing about Magneto is that he, like, you generally kind of understand where he's coming from. And, like, granted, the version that McKellen's played, I mean, like, we first met him when he was willing to kill Rogue for the sake of his goal.
Yeah, but even that, we saw more struggle.
Yeah.
There than this. This is not even killing somebody.
And he's
this
been
is just
like,
being kind to someone who took a bullet for you.
It's like, and who's supposed to be like one of his, I mean, X2 does such a great right. job of setting them up as kind of like a duo. Like they're like, she's his like right-hand person. And so mm-hmm. it's just so like, that's the other thing, by the way, like the, I think the reason I say disappointing for this movie is there were so many things that were set up as interesting in X2 specifically that just were never realized. Like they tried to, but it's like even the pyro thing, like I thought that that moment in X2 when he like decides to turn and go with Magneto is kind of like a dark, significant moment. But I don't like him at all as Magneto's right-hand guy. I don't feel like it's not bad, but it doesn't add anything to me. Like, and
no, it is. Well, it is bad. It is bad. It's like that. Even that doesn't make sense. Like Magneto has total control of metal, but then all of a sudden at the very end, when he just wants to throw car bombs, literal car bombs, he's lost his accuracy. Now all of a sudden it's like, he's just kind of spraying them around while people are hiding.
Right.
Like, what is he trying to hit with that or accomplish?
Well, and also, like, why, like, just, and I, look, I'm
do
not
they
like
need
a,
to be on fire?
Well, and I'm not like a, physics guy over here, and I know that like, these movies, like, I'm thinking of Civil War, where it's like, man, that thing does not obey the laws of physics at all. Like, I know that superhero movies do that, but I was struck by, like, okay, how is Bobby stopping these midair by freezing them? Like, if Magneto's still forcing it along, like, I don't know that Bobby's right, like, we right. haven't been shown that his, like, I get that it makes intuitive sense that when you freeze a thing it stands still, but I don't think that that's how that would work. Like, I don't think it would stop all momentum and just like have it drop to the ground.
There are so many things about that. That's what I was saying. Like, we just saw Magneto channel iron from someone's blood to then destroy them. But you're telling me he can't find any metal here in this last fight? Like, there's like, no metal on that island to stop the people that are turning all of your troops into humans, curing them all?
Like, he has the bridge right behind him. He could, like,
I know, like,
he could
just
peel
that.
Off, like, flakes of the steel beams and just, like, pulverize everybody and, like,
That's where the power levels thing does matter, I think, because you're not following rules. Like, there's just no rhyme or reason. Like, all of a sudden, Magneto feels kind of neutered. And I right. don't know, like, is this the same Magneto that flew with a baseball stadium? Literally?
Anyways. Like, by contrast, the Jean Grey power set is so
right.
over the top.
Yep.
That I'm like...
But okay, let's talk about that. Even that. So Jean Grey is literally disintegrating every human she sees. Even mutants, she just disintegrates right. them. But now at the very end, Logan can walk through it?
Like,
I know Logan has a healing power. I get that. But she's instantly disintegrating everybody.
Right.
How does Logan have time to fight through that? And I remembered that when I started seeing it, I'm like, oh, I remember this scene. I thought it was more of a struggle than it was. Like, dude, everything about the final fight, Robbie. Oh no. Like, even the Juggernaut side of this all.
Oh,
like,
man.
Okay, if your plan was just to break through and grab the kid, why did you wait so long? Why did you just send the Juggernaut as the first thing?
Right.
And then like,
I guess
he's
they would
ultimately
say
just stopped by Kitty pulling him through the floor kind of thing and bonking his head.
Yeah.
Dude, none of it makes sense at the end. Okay, I'm going to get off it for a second. My other question, not question, but you were right about Scott Cyclops.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the first movie, you said he's actually really cool. And I agree. I was like, oh my gosh, he is really cool. And I think that is telling that his performance leaves that much of a memorable mark, because I remember Cyclops being a big thing. But you're right. In the second movie, he gets sidelined.
Uh-huh.
And then he's not here in this movie.
Yeah.
So essentially, the regret is we just don't really get hardly any Cyclops for years.
Which is so strange. Yeah, because it's like, and then they try to rectify that in Origins, but like, I've never understood what Cyclops adds to that movie other than them just recognizing like we probably wanted more of him. But it's like he's just kind of around, and at one point, like, he uses his eye blast to take out some of the, like, the soldiers shooting at them. And it's like, I guess then we get Cyclops again, I think circa Apocalypse. But I don't feel like that version ever really worked for me. Granted, I was never super invested in that generation of X-Men
films.
We'll find
out. We'll find out.
But yeah, I like...
Also, you know, we talk about Magneto's skill as a general and stuff. I literally wrote in my notes, when they go in to see Jean and Storm and Logan are outside, and he goes, don't let them come in here. And I wrote down, oh, don't worry, Hedgehog guy, Miles from Lost, he'll stop him. He'll stop Storm for sure. Right. I'm like, how is that? How did Hedgehog guy make Magneto's inner circle? His only power is to hug you and then spike you. Storm is literally just going to throw a tornado at him.
Yeah.
It's so illogical.
And that whole thing, like, it's, it reminds me of what I've talked about with, obviously, like, to a much lesser degree with Hawkeye, where I feel like I've said, like, the fact that Kingpin is associating so much with the, like, trust a bro guys always felt like it brought him down a tad, like, in status.
Yes.
And
Magneto not being able to choose his cabinet brings him down.
Man, yeah. It's like because it's like he's always seemed, even in X-97, like, he's like a mutant, like, somewhere between like a mutant celebrity and like deity to some degree. Like, people hold him in such high regard. He's like so powerful, but he's also got this kind of like dark nobility to him. And it's just like, it's what makes the final scene in Remember It work so well. But yeah, here it's like all the stuff you've already said, and then the fact that he's hanging out with all of these like kind of mutant like rejects, like
losers,
like D-list mutants. It's just such Magneto.
While we're talking about the biggest glow downs and disappointing characters in the history of the series, Rogue sucks, man.
What a
horrible casting to be watching this while contrasting this to Rogue from X-Men 97. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, X-Men 97 Rogue is powerful and confident and runs the show and is emotional and heartbroken. And this, we get a stale, insecure kid who basically has no power other than, please just don't touch me.
Right.
And that's her only concern, that nothing else matters. I just can't touch people. You can with a glove, by the way, but you just cannot touch skin to skin. And that's going to be all consuming. And that's the whole plot.
Right.
There's no other side of Rogue.
Right.
Except she can't touch her boyfriend. I'm like, I'm so over it, dude. It's so annoying.
And you know what?
And what a missed opportunity when I see what Rogue could be.
Yeah. Well, and it does make me curious to see. I don't know that I've actually watched it, but I'm going to when we get to Days of Future Past, especially since we watched the regular Days of Future Past a couple years ago. I want to watch the Rogue cut that Singer released after the fact that somehow weaves her character into that movie. I've heard that it's well done. I don't really have any idea what that entails, but I'm curious, like,
here we go. Release the singer cut.
I've always thought that that Rogue, like, I've always felt that way. I think I probably said that in our first X-Men watch episode here, that it's such a disappointing take on the character. But to Singer's credit here, creatively, I understand the role that she was playing, especially in the first film and even in the second film, because she's kind of supposed to be still the kid that Logan's having to kind of take care of. And in that sense, it's like, yeah, like that makes sense. You're giving Logan this role that, again, works so well when we make it back to that in Logan. But it's like, as soon as, like, by the time we get here, whenever all of the other younger X-Men are now, like, active team members and Rogue is just kind of there being sad, it's like, what is this? What are we doing here? Like, what? And it's like, it's such a, like, maybe they were just trying to make it make sense why Bobby would be drawn to Kitty, because, like, it's so bleak with Rogue, but, like, man.
But it's also so brutal. Hanukkah was like, man, this is brutal. Like, now we have to stomp on Rogue even more. Then now Now Bobby's kind of cheating on her-ish in taking Kitty on these dates.
Yeah.
Other than, like, the plot and all the main characters and the movie existing, it's actually really great. So other than that, you know, it's a really great film.
So,
dude, I know I'm being so negative. I have more. What's sad is, like, I'm rushing us through this because I have even more. Why not at the very end of the film cure Jean instead of kill her?
Right.
Why not take one of the glow sticks of life or whatever up, and then when you're about to stab her, actually just inject her with that, so at least she can live life as a normal human then. Is that a bad idea?
No, I mean, especially because, like, they used three of them on Magneto, which, like, I don't think we have any reason to believe that you have to use three. So I'm like, could you have used, like, one of those two on Magneto and two on Phoenix?
Why not at least save her life with that? Also, at the very end, Magneto's playing chess. Wouldn't he still be tried for war crimes? I mean, how is he still in the park just playing chess? Yes, he is a human now.
That's true.
I mean, he still just literally destroyed a national monument and attacked people and killed a lot of soldiers.
And he's been a fugitive from the events of the last two films still. Like, he broke out of prison. And when we first start the movie, they were like, it's like a manhunt for Magneto. So even not taking into account all the stuff he does in this movie, yeah, he should be a fugitive.
Nobody in the park's going, hey, that's the guy. That's the guy that's been attacking us all these years. He's just sitting here playing chess. What the heck with Charles in the post-credit sequence? He comes back to life in somebody else's body?
Yeah, man. I don't even know what that was supposed to be. And I've tried to look it up over the years. Like, I know that Penn said that they wanted to leave that, like, they wanted a Charles death because they felt like it needed to have that emotional heft in the movie, but that they wanted to leave the door open. And so, but it's just weird to me, like, this isn't even a, like, and not only is it not explained here, this is it. Like, this is all we ever understand for why, whenever we meet back up with Charles in Days of Future Past, there's never any more explanation than this for why he's still alive. And that's what's crazy to me. They're just like, yeah, no, I mean, he's reborn in the body of a comatose patient that is also Patrick Stewart. What questions do you have?
I hate it. It makes me sick.
And Moira, right. By the way, we've got dueling Moiras.
It's a different Moira. Why?
Like, I think so. That actually does lead into something that I discovered here that I was not aware of, in terms of the development of this movie. I did not, like, I knew that Bryan Singer was, that he left to go do Superman Returns, and that Ratner came in to ultimately fill in for him, and that's kind of the result of the vision being so off and whatever. Although I was also reading what Singer's original high-level pitch would have been for this movie, and it seems like it could have potentially been worse. So I don't know that, like, I want to give Singer too much hypothetical credit, but I didn't realize that there were a lot of steps between Singer leaving and Ratner being the director. Apparently, this movie went through so many potential directors that it was, after Singer left, I think the first choice was supposed to be Matthew Vaughn, who directed First Class. And then Matthew Vaughn, I think it was something where it was kind of like, I think Justice League with Snyder leaving. Like, I think Vaughn had to leave because he had some, like, family stuff going on. And that was the only reason he backed out. And then they were kind of left with, like, they had the script more or less. And Matthew Vaughn had apparently come in and actually, like, storyboarded stuff and rewritten a lot. So that, like, I think even the movie that we got was heavily influenced by his kind of early work on it. He also made some casting calls, and I think the casting calls he made are actually the best ones, in that, like, he's the one that brought in Kelsey Grammer and Elliot Page. And I, you know, like, those stick around in some, you know, to some degree. We get both of those characters briefly in, well, we get a lot of Elliot Page in Days of Future Past. We get a brief shout out to Kelsey Grammer. But once he left and had kind of made his mark, they then start going through this, like, revolving door of potential directors. And just to name, like, a few, Joss Whedon was considered, because the whole Cure storyline is based on a Joss Whedon X-Men comic that came out around the same time this movie was being produced. And so I think they thought, we want to adapt this. We should just bring in the guy that wrote it and is also a film director. But Whedon bowed out because, I guess, at the time he was working on a Wonder Woman film that never materialized. Zack Snyder was considered, but he bowed out because he was already committed to 300. Guillermo del Toro was considered, but he turned it down because he was committed to Pan's Labyrinth. And then
nobody wanted it.
yeah. And so finally it winds up with Brett Ratner, who then, I guess, was so unfamiliar.
And then Steven Spielberg was considered, but he turned it down. And then Christopher Nolan was considered, and he turned it down.
Yeah, man.
Then Martin Scorsese was considered, but he had to pass. So we went with Brett Ratner.
What I think is interesting, the Matthew Vaughn piece of that is what I was thinking, because you're talking about like the multiple Moiras, right? Like, Vaughn has spoken about this movie and his take on it, because the fact that he worked on it and then came in and did First Class, I think there was a good bit of press where he was kind of dogging on this. And I think what separates the X-Men franchise from, or I guess I should say more, what separates the MCU from other franchises, because other franchises do similar things. X-Men's just the worst about it. But, like, Matthew Vaughn clearly kind of, it left a bad taste in his mouth, not only the movie as a whole, but specifically he, like, called out Brett Ratner as just doing a bad job, and how, like, if he had gotten to finish the movie, it would have been better and had more heart and whatever. But I still think, like, okay, I get that. The movie's bad. We all know that the movie's bad. There are ways to pivot, especially if you're going back in time to the 60s. that don't require breaking with continuity. Like, you don't have to now introduce another Moira that is totally different. Like, you don't now have to, like, totally retroact. Like, maybe you're bummed about what happened to Mystique. I get that. You don't have to now make Mystique this, like, fundamental sister to Charles. Like, it's, in some ways, like, it's more egregious to me that Matthew Vaughn had such a large role in both of these, and then that Singer has such a large role, obviously, in Days of Future Past, and I think was also, like, at least an executive producer and maybe had a story credit on First Class, where I'm like, okay, all of y'all, like, had your hands in all this stuff. Like, there was really no excuse for you not at least trying to, like, veer away from outright contradictions. Like, I get, like, let's just not touch this again because it was terrible. That's totally fair. But why in the very next movie introduce things that just go directly against not just this movie, but also the stuff that came before this movie? It's just like, that was, I had never known that Vaughn had any involvement in these earlier entries. And so I think that that was just, like, baffling to me to read about.
I like Beast. That's my only positive note.
Okay, no, I was going to ask, actually, what is your take on Beast now, kind of having seen the version of the character in X-Men 97?
I like Beast.
It feels pretty accurate, I think. I like this Beast
a lot more than Nicholas Holt's. I love that Kelsey Grammer loved doing it and that he desperately wanted to come back. That makes me so happy that he somehow found enough fun and fulfillment in this particular role that he wanted to come back. So the fact that we brought him back in the Marvels just warms my heart. And so I was probably already preconditioned to enjoy what he was doing, but I felt like in general, the conception of the character and the acting and performance and the visual of it was a step up from so much of the stuff going on in the film. Not only was he believable, but I like the character. I like him, you know, advancing in the government and working with the president. Like, that's a different take. That's something new, having a mutant on board that other humans have to listen to.
Yeah.
I like Beast.
Yeah. I mean, it is weird that, like, I like watching this after First Class because you at least understand who Beast is and why he's blue and all of that stuff. Like, I do think that that helps. I think, like the other characters, there are things where it's like, yeah, I don't really know that this feels like the same character to me because, like the version of Beast in the cartoon, this version of Beast is like, he's funny and charming and, like, he's a diplomat. Whereas, like, the version of Beast that we get in all of the, I'll keep evaluating this as we move forward in the McAvoy Fassbender timeline. But, like, I feel like it's kind of the opposite. Like, he's the, like,
well, he's also really young. That's 30 years ago.
Yeah, but he's like intensely antisocial and shy and, like, crazy, crazy smart in a way where it's like they're not painting him as the kind of guy that is,
yeah,
like, but jolly and
lovable.
He came
out of his shell a little bit, okay?
That's fair. That's fair.
I see what you're saying.
But yeah, I that was actually another reason for me that I appreciated having First Class before this, is so the you're at least, you have some understanding of, like, what his power set is. Otherwise, it's like, what can this guy do? And then you just see him show up and, like, punch and kick people. But I think that, like, that's one of the weird things about this movie as a whole, that I saw Matthew Vaughn say this. Like, as grateful as I am that I didn't have to sit through more of this movie than I did, you are juggling so many different subplots, and this is supposed to be this epic conclusion to this trilogy. It's kind of wild that when you're trying to do all that, you have a movie that was wildly expensive for the time. Why commit yourself to a runtime that is so far under the average superhero movie. Like, it's like 100 minutes or 104 minutes.
I think 144, an hour 44 is what it was.
Which was like, again, I'm not saying that I wanted more of this movie, but I saw Matthew Vaughn saying that his version would have been 30 to 45 minutes longer, which kind of makes sense. Like, it would land somewhere for sure. In the
nothing,
2.5 hours.
Nothing feels super developed. No, that's why I said anticlimactic, because every individual little story we're trying to do doesn't quite hit right. And I do think a little more time would have been beneficial.
An hour
44 is pretty short.
I know. Like, I mean, I wish that this and Spider-Man 3 had traded run times. Like, because it's sort of like, at least with the Raimi trilogy.
But let's be honest, that's not the only thing that would have fixed it. So
No. But I do think that, like, of the two, Spider-Man 3 had way too much going on in general, and it also took way too much time doing all of it. Like, that's an example of a movie.
The horror that we're all seeing right now live.
It's
on television.
The brutality of it. I think that if, like, that's a movie like, you know, like Love and Thunder.
Monica and I still love so many of those memes where, like, the solution is just banging on poles, you know? So, hey. Like, the poles can fix it.
It worked in Dark World too. You know, anytime you've got some poles around.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think, and the only reason I bring that up is for all of the issues there, I still think that, like, you can kind of pull out Spider-Man 3. And the first two films kind of work on their own, I think. Like, and that's why I made the joke when we were doing that watch through that those are the only Spider-Man movies Raimi ever made. Because it kind of ends it in this, like, okay, yeah, he's back in this responsibility thing. And he's, like, kind of got the girl, but kind of not. And I think that that's, like, a good place. Like, there are no dangling threads beyond, like, oh, the Goblin might be coming back. But, like, even that could have kind of, like, that's going to be an additional villain. The thing with X-Men is they leave a lot dangling there that, like, they needed to resolve. Like, they were setting it up, like, Magneto's off, they're building to something. And it's just strange to me that you would then limit yourself in such a way where, like, it has to be considerably shorter than either of the first two. I haven't done, like, a runtime comparison, but I think that both of those were at least 2 hours.
I would think so. I am now at this for my power rankings. X2, a gap. X1, First Class. Those two are really close. And then I would go X3 and Origins Wolverine. Although, I think in some ways, like, I didn't say almost anything positive about this movie at all. So in some ways, Origins Wolverine is maybe even better. But it's a little bit of, like, the what the movie's trying to do, the necessity of the film in general. Like, it's hard to watch Origins Wolverine and think to yourself, like, this was super needed on any level. But in a weird way, there are certain things about Origins Wolverine that I was able to praise, like Hugh Jackman a little bit, that X3 doesn't do. So anyways, those two are the bottom two, but I think I'm gonna go X3 better. Yeah, just because of what it's trying to do, and that we check in with all the characters again. Like, it's an Avengers film essentially, so I think I probably just am biased toward that.
Yeah. But
X2, X1, First Class, X3, Origins Wolverine, with the Wolverine coming up, and I have no idea where that one's gonna go, so that'll be fun. But yeah, in general, I don't know, man.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's just how I consume this movie, or
the
order, or how I was feeling when I watched it. I don't know. I didn't think it was that awesome. That's my review.
No, I think, I mean, this was such a a formative era, like this like 2 year period where these like highly anticipated conclusions to a trilogy came out and they were so disappointing. Like I remember, cause again, it's like X2 I think still the best X-Men movie. I think Spider-Man 2 is still arguably the best Spider-Man live action movie. And like then to have those follow up with the possible low points of both franchises is just like, it was such a demoralizing thing that I think it's these movies like X3 and Spider-Man 3, now that we've kind of covered both, I think combined with like a slew of other like really forgettable like Ghost Rider type movies that were coming out really set the stage for like The Dark Knight and Iron Man to be what they were. Because people had such a like that's why I was joking about reading some of these old reviews and people talking about superhero fatigue, you know, in 2008. And, or at least like, yeah, 2008 or 2009, I guess, when Origins is coming out. And then that compared with like how we then launched, you know, the biggest superhero franchises maybe of all time. This was the end of an era of superhero movies, I think. But it was also the end of an era of X-Men movies where they finally, by the time we get back to First Class, for better or worse, they're no longer running from the aesthetic of like the 90s cartoon show or the comics. Like they're finally getting to a point where they're okay having some colorful costumes and doing things that feel a little bit more comic booky and not so broody.
It is a fascinating discussion to look at all the different franchises at different points in time. I'd love to have that talk at some point because if I got all of these films, all of the DC films, all the original Marvel films, and if I had them all written down and I was looking at them linearly of when they released, I wonder if you could find like an explainable trend as to why the MCU was the way it was. Like for example, Iron Man coming out kind of around all of this stuff. I can see how if I was a fan of all this stuff at the time, I'd be like, wow, that was really refreshing and kind of really a game changer mm-hmm. in tone and how the movie feels very realistic the whole time, especially if you're like coming off something like this with the Golden Gate Bridge and the Cure and all this stuff.
Right.
But really, I wonder if was it the Avengers kind of really sticking the landing? Was that a bigger deal then? Turning point? Like at some point people went, oh, Marvel Studios know how to do it. And Kevin Feige and the rest of this junk got lost. And I just kind of wonder, I'd love to look at it. Like, I wonder if it was like Winter Soldier nailing it in 2014 that people were like, oh, okay, this is different. Was it the first Avengers? Was it like the first time? Because like you just talked about Spider-Man didn't know how to end their trilogy. And then X-Men didn't know how to end their trilogy. Was it
right?
The first conclusion of a trilogy? I don't know.
I think that the Avengers,
I think
was it. Cause it kind of was the conclusion.
Yeah, I think so too. That's why I said that first. It was the conclusion of like that first phase of all those individual films. And they stuck the landing in such a powerful way. Remember I talked about how I left the theater going, that was one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life. It was everything that this movie wasn't. And maybe that was kind of the turning point around this time, 2012. And people were like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I think that that's right. Because it was also like, you know, we've talked about how I thought that the Avengers movie was going to be a disaster because in part of these movies.
Yeah, of all this stuff. And because of, putting together like, Thor and Captain America and stuff, you know.
And like how you balance all that, because it's like every time someone had tried to do that, it was such a mess.
Even on MCU standards, when Avengers was coming out, I mean, now in hindsight, we can look back at it differently, but they had put out some of their worst movies in the entire saga. Like Thor 1 is one of the, I think, you know, one of the weakest, if not the weakest film. Incredible Hulk, Captain America even isn't, you know, that high on my list, and Iron Man 2. You know, so like to stick the landing in the Avengers is actually a miracle because, I mean, at the time, those were still cool movies, but I'm saying like those are all bottom tier movies now.
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's like, that's why I do think that that was the moment and that it just felt so like after all of this, like not only are these movies messy, they're also kind of unnecessarily bleak. Like Spider-Man 3 is that way too, where it's like, I think that something like Avengers coming in and being so
colorful,
like and, fun
yeah,
and hopeful.
And
yeah.
The tone change. Yeah. The tone change from Iron Man 1 original, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Like just to have like jokes.
I mean, I think that that's in part why like I always find it so interesting tracing the development of the early MCU with the Nolan Batman trilogy and the Dark Knight coming out in 08 and Rises coming out in 12 with the Avengers, where it's like, I really think that in a lot of ways that was the peak moment for the superhero genre, like not the MCU obviously, but I mean, it's like, that was it. Like that's where it's like, okay, here are two definitive approaches to telling superhero stories. One is really willing to lean into the fun of that and kind of go all out and do like a space invasion and be funny and colorful. And the other is doing the like dark thing, really like full on embracing like the reality of that and the groundedness. And they're both doing it kind of as well as they can be done. At least, that, you know, to that point. And I still think Avengers...
And people love both.
Yeah, exactly. It's like...
So there's room for both.
But then from there, you know, Marvel keeps leaning into what they're doing and getting better and better at it. And I think every other franchise starts trying to land in one of two spots and always winds up in some awkward middle ground.
Yeah.
Whether it's like the Garfield Spider-Man or DC stuff.
Well, and that's the beauty of Nolan, I think, is that, you know, he doesn't have that other history and he's a large enough name that I don't think what Marvel was doing would ever influence what he was making anyways. But yeah, it almost feels like once other DC films tried to start implementing some of that, like the whole Joss Whedon-ness of the Snyder Cut, mm-hmm. is actually where it missteps, because like, that's not what you do. Like, that's not, like, you're not going to do it as well as them. So maybe go the opposite. Like we talk about with the Batman, right? Like, right. That's a perfect example of like, if you're not going to be able to do this other thing, then don't even try.
Yeah,
and make this thing. And they did. And it's fantastic.
I do. But I mean, I think that it's worth having as we are finishing this, because the X-Men, like we said, the first film really kicked off the modern era of superhero movies.
And by the time this movie was releasing, it was getting passed by these other things.
Yeah.
At least around the time.
So I think it's because of that, like I'm really excited again with our watch order to have definitely Origins out of the way, but even First Class to just kind of feel like we can start moving ahead and skipping even some of the awkward stuff in that movie and just following Logan's next steps here to the Wolverine, because I think that we at least... Like, even if we miss out on some of the, like, immediate aftermath tragedy of X2 by not going straight to X3, I think whatever we lose there, we gain by kind of following the impact of the events here and seeing how that affects Logan and, like, getting a better look at his character that we clearly... didn't get an Origins, but even if we did, it wouldn't matter because he lost all of his memories anyway. Like I'm actually excited because I haven't seen the Wolverine very many times. And it's James Mangold who also did Logan. It's obviously very different, but you know, you have a filmmaker who I think has some clout, and it's nice to get back to that after Origins and The Last Stand. So I like that we that we're kind of wrapping this mid-2000s era, and then the next movie that we're watching is a 2013 movie that then kind of brings us into more or less the like phase two Marvel era and kind of how X-Men is responding to that.
Next time, 2 weeks from today, The Wolverine, right back here on Friends from Work.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90 exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.